Hamas released hostages and Israel, in turn, released Palestinian prisoners. Tuesday, the fifth day of an extended ceasefire in the Gaza war.
There are efforts to extend the ceasefire even longer. The head of the Israeli Mossad is in Qatar right now trying to negotiate an extension.
Plus, the chief of the main U.S. spy agency is visiting Doha for key talks on what happens next in the fight between Israel and Hamas.
The high-level talks, according to the official, are focused on the Israel-Hamas conflict, now in its 53rd day, and on the up to 175 hostages still being held by Hamas.
Today is Wednesday, November 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. Hamas released 12 hostages and Israel released 30 Palestinian prisoners on the fifth day of a fragile ceasefire in the Gaza war that mediators hope to extend even as both Israel and Hamas have pledged to resume fighting. I spoke with Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem about the latest prisoner exchange and other issues concerning the Israel-Hamas war. Linda, what can you tell us about Tuesday's prisoner exchange?
A total of 10 Israeli women, 9 women, many of them elderly, and a teenage girl were released from Gaza, along with 2 Thai hostages. They just arrived back in Israel after they were freed from Hamas captivity, and Israel is scheduled to release another 30 Palestinian prisoners, all women, today. What it means, however, is that there are still 10 children who are being held in Gaza, and the fact that none of them were freed seems to indicate that Hamas does not have those children. There are the 2 youngest hostages, 2 little boys who are 10 months and 4 years old, who were captured with their parents, and they've kind of become the poster children for the hostages still remaining in Gaza, and apparently Hamas gave them to another group, and so today's release is all women and 1 teenage girl.
Any idea of what this group or who this group is that has the infants?
Yes, it's apparently a group called the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. But one of the ideas of the ceasefire was that Hamas would try to get the children and the women that it did not have under its control, that it would try to collect them during the ceasefire. The family of the Bibas family said they hope that they will not be sort of held indefinitely. But there is really some concern about their future. And these 2 little boys have orange carrot top hair and have kind of become an iconic symbol of the hostages. There are still at least 150 hostages still being held.
Any discussion regarding tomorrow, the final day of the ceasefire, and the hostage exchange?
Well, first of all, there are efforts to extend the ceasefire even longer. The head of the Israeli Mossad is in Qatar right now trying to negotiate an extension. And Israel had said that it was willing to extend the ceasefire for a total of 10 days, as long as Hamas kept releasing prisoners. And in fact, Israel, when it published its original list of the Palestinian prisoners who could be freed, published a list of 300 names. So that would be a total of 10-day ceasefire. So it's possible that it will continue for a few more days. We don't have the names on who will be released tomorrow. In addition, there was an incident today in which Hamas attacked Israeli troops in Gaza and explosive devices detonated near the troops and a few soldiers were wounded. And the army says that the military is ready to resume fighting, but that they will consider themselves still holding to the truce. Hamas has accused Israel of violations of the truce, so it's still somewhat shaky.
Linda, another aspect of the ceasefire is not only the exchange of hostages, but so that humanitarian aid can get into those who need it in Gaza. Are you seeing this, and what kind of aid is coming through?
Yes, quite a lot of aid is coming through, of food and medicine and cooking oil and gas for cars and things. Now, the question is whether Hamas, any of that aid is getting to Hamas, which is what's happened in the past. Israel has said that it inspects everything to make sure there are no weapons and that it's making sure that it's getting only to the people who need it. But I actually spoke to someone in Gaza today, and he told me that there is kind of a sense that they can breathe for the first time, and for the first time, the UNRWA, the UN, would distribute distributed cooking oil to them. And he said until then, they've basically been cooking with wood on outdoor fires. He said it was like Gaza went back 50 years. So there is aid getting in. There's still a challenge because for 50 days, not a lot of aid was getting in. So there's still kind of a deficit of what needs to be made up. But for Palestinians in Gaza who've been living in fear of Israeli airstrikes and with a death toll of over 14,000, according to the health ministry, which of course is affiliated with Hamas, but you're talking about a very welcome break.
The chief of the main U.S. spy agency is visiting Doha for key talks on what happens next in the fight between Israel and Hamas. VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden has more.
U.S. officials rarely talk about travel plans for CIA Director William Burns. But a U.S. official confirms to VOA Burns is currently in Doha. The high-level talks, according to the official, are focused on the Israel-Hamas conflict, now in its 53rd day, and on the up to 175 hostages still being held by Hamas. Paul Piller, a former CIA officer who now teaches at Georgetown University, tells VOA the goal seems to be to keep the current pause in fighting in place.
The objective of the administration at the moment clearly is to try to extend the truce or ceasefire as long as possible and get as many hostages released as much as possible.
This is at least the second time this month Burns has traveled to the Middle East following the October 7th terror attack by Hamas that killed some 1,200 people. Earlier this month, U.S. officials said the CIA director visited several countries in the region to discuss the Israeli response. Piller says it's not surprising, given Burns' background.
He is a highly accomplished and very much respected, both at home and abroad, diplomat. So he has become, for the Biden administration, a very useful general-purpose diplomatic troubleshooter on matters that may have little or nothing to do with his day job as the CIA director.
As for Qatar, it's played a key role in facilitating talks between Israel and Hamas, most recently helping to negotiate the extended pause in fighting in exchange for the release of 50 of the Hamas-held hostages and 150 Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
Rescuers in northern India have freed 41 workers from inside a collapsed tunnel where they had been stuck for 17 days. Associated Press correspondent Karen Shamus reports.
Ambulance sirens blare out at the site of the collapsed tunnel in Uttarakhand state in northern India. 41 workers were rescued from the collapsed mountain tunnel after being trapped in there for over 2 weeks. The workers were pulled out through a passageway made of welded pipes that rescuers previously pushed through dirt and rocks. About a dozen men had worked overnight to manually dig through rock and debris using handheld digging tools. The drilling machine initially used broke down after boring through nearly 154 feet. The men became trapped after a landslide caused a portion of the tunnel they were building to collapse. They survived on food and oxygen supplied through narrow steel pipes. I'm Karen Chamas.
20 people were killed and nearly 2,000 inmates escaped during Sunday's attack on a military barracks, a prison, and other locations in Sierra Leone, officials said Monday. Reuters' Almond Lee reports.
Sierra Leone authorities said Monday that 20 people were killed and nearly 2,000 prisoners escaped during Sunday's attack on the capital. Gunfire was heard ringing out across Freetown as assailants targeted a military barracks, a prison, and other locations. An army spokesperson told Reuters that the 20 dead included 13 soldiers, 3 assailants, a police officer, a civilian, and someone working in private security. The government has since reduced an all-day curfew to a nightly one, and police were checking vehicles at checkpoints. Shops and businesses started to reopen on Monday afternoon, but the fear among residents remains. This woman says it was the first time she had heard a gunshot and that she hid under her bed. The government blamed the attacks on renegade soldiers and this resident recalled encountering them.
Military vehicles approached us and some of the officers said we should shout forcefully, "President Mada Bio must go." Some of us wanted to answer and some refused to shout. We asked him for which reason we should say that, and he responded by asking if we had the ability to buy expensive bags of rice.
Let us come.
Hours after the rampage, President Julius Mada Bio assured citizens calm had been restored and that the attackers would be held to account. Last year, anti-government protests erupted over soaring living costs, and at least 21 civilians were killed in the unrest. Sierra Leone, which is still recovering from a 1991 to 2002 civil war in which more than 50,000 were killed, has been tense since Bio was re-elected in June.
That was Reuters reporter Amon Lee. We're following these other stories from around the world. The Biden administration has told Israel it must operate with far greater precision in southern Gaza if it renews a ground campaign aimed at eradicating the Hamas militant group. That's according to senior administration officials who briefed reporters on the condition of anonymity under ground rules set by the White House. An elevator suddenly dropped around 200 meters while carrying workers to the surface in a platinum mine in South Africa, killing 11 and injuring 75, 14 of them critically, the mine operator said Tuesday. It happened Monday evening at the end of the workers' shift at a mine in the northern city of Rustenburg. All the injured workers were hospitalized. Pope Francis has canceled his trip to Dubai for the UN Climate Conference on doctor's orders. The announcement marked the second time the Pope's frail health has forced the cancellation of a foreign trip. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg emphasized Tuesday the importance of continuing to provide support for Ukraine.
It's our obligation to ensure that we provide Ukraine with the weapons they need. Because it will be a tragedy for Ukrainians if President Putin wins, but it will also be dangerous for us. Because then the message to all authoritarian leaders, not only in Moscow but also in Beijing, is that when they violate international law, when they invade another country, when they use force, they get what they want.
U.S. lawmakers are racing to reach a deal on billions of dollars in aid to Ukraine and Israel before the holiday break. VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson, has more.
As snow blankets Ukraine, and Ukrainian troops brace for another hard winter of fighting, aid crucial to Ukraine's fight against Russian aggression is in jeopardy in the U.S. Congress.
For weeks, long weeks, a handful of Republicans have dangerously tried to link Ukraine aid and make our support for democracy in the West a pivotal issue that history will remember us for, conditional on passing hard right border policies.
The White House has requested $106 billion in national security funding, including $60 billion for Ukraine and nearly $14 billion in aid for Israel. While most Senate Republicans support that aid, they are asking for billions in funding for border security in return.
I called the president last week to make sure he understood that there wouldn't be a bill without a credible effort to get on top of our disastrous southern border situation. I hope that made the point, because I think on our side, I've been the most enthusiastic supporter of the underlying bill.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said passage of the aid package in the U.S. Congress is one of three key victories Ukraine needs on the international front.
It's a challenge. It's not easy.
But U.S. lawmakers have only a few weeks left in the session before heading home for the holidays. And the White House says the aid already distributed to Ukraine is running dangerously low.
We didn't just pull those figures out of thin air. It was very much in keeping with what our partners have told us they need for the coming months. And in both cases, the runway keeps getting shorter and shorter.
Many Republicans have expressed concern about continued aid while there are many pressing domestic needs. One analyst told VOA the debate over Ukraine aid can't be separated from domestic political concerns.
Some of the critics of Ukraine aid would say, well, yeah, Ukraine is important, or Ukraine's in trouble, but we have a lot of domestic needs. We have poverty, we have border issues, we have other national issues, and so we should be spending the money on that. And I think that that's a false dichotomy. A great country can do two things, or more than two things, at the same time.
Opposition to aid to Ukraine is more significant in the Republican-majority U.S. House of Representatives. But Speaker of the House Mike Johnson has said he is confident it will pass. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
Russian President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday warned the West ahead of Russian elections in March 2024 that any foreign meddling would be considered an act of aggression.
Мы знаем, какой угрозе.
We know what threat we are up against. Today, Russophobia and other forms of racism and neo-Nazism have become almost the official ideology of the Western ruling elites. They are directed not only against Russians, but also against all the peoples of Russia. The Kremlin chief said the Russophobia casts Russians as a people of backward slaves and warned the United States allegedly wanted to plunder Russia's vast resources. Argentine workers marched on Buenos Aires on Tuesday to demand better pay and social protections as the country grapples with triple-digit inflation and concerns over far-right libertarian president-elect Javier Milei. Kristalina Georgieva, the head of the International Monetary Fund, is very keen to support Argentina.
Then again, we are very keen to support Argentina, address the deep problem of inflation, create an environment for private sector, led growth that can perk up employment and the economy overall. So we have already had our first virtual meeting with the president-elect, a very, very constructive engagement, very serious discussion.
The IMF chief also says the country could be a candidate to receive financing through its Resilience and Sustainability Trust. A little more than a year after becoming Malaysia's prime minister in late November 2022, Anwar Ibrahim is getting mixed reviews from political analysts. As the country's fifth prime minister in less than 5 years, some credit his sustained grasp on power with bringing political stability to the country. Survey results released by the Merdeka Center for Opinion Research, however, say Anwar's approval rating dropped to 50% compared to 68% a year ago. It also showed substantially increased dissatisfaction with government's handling of the economy. The dumping yard in the Aiken area of Srinagar on the Indian side of Kashmir wreaks havoc for locals in the capital city. The area was known for farming and wetlands, but today the heaps of garbage have reached the height of a mountain. For VOA, Muhit ul Islam has more from Srinagar in Indian-administered Kashmir.
This is one of the largest dumping sites in the Aachen area of Srinagar on the Indian side of Kashmir. Hundreds of vehicles come here daily to unload all kinds of waste collected from around the capital city. Until 1984, there were farms and wetlands here, but then the government designated 30 hectares of empty land for waste management. Now there's a big mountain of garbage here. Majid Ahmad Zardu lives nearby. He says they face multiple issues due to the dumping site, including foul smell. Birds and animals spread sickness from the dirt. He adds that the residents have appealed to the government to relocate the site, but their concerns have been consistently ignored. Residents say the Aachen dumping yard emits a noxious odor, particularly in summer, impacting residents who live up to 6 kilometers away. The smell also engulfs Sher-e Kashmir Institute of Medical Science, a crucial health facility located nearby. Health experts say dumping sites foster microbes and can pose health risks among the residents living nearby that can lead to illnesses like diarrhea,
chest infections, liver failure, and lung cancer.
Dr. Nesarul Hassan is a prominent influenza expert in Kashmir.
These dumping sites, they emit the gaseous things like methane, which is toxic to the lungs. So we have a lot of people coming with respiratory illnesses because of this dumping site from that area. And another huge issue is that there are a lot of chemicals that spill into the water bodies and making it unfit for human consumption.
Local environment experts are urging the government to find another site for waste management, one that does not allow residential homes nearby. Ijaz Rasool, an environmentalist, suggests that the government adopt modern technologies for waste disposal, not only in Srinagar, but throughout the valley. He says the land has been used as a dumping site since 1984 and there is no space left. And he adds the government must find an alternative for solid waste management in Srinagar, prioritizing proactive solutions to prevent recurring issues faced today. The commissioner of Srinagar Municipal Corporation, a civic body governing Srinagar, did not respond to VOA requests for comment. However, another Srinagar Municipal Corporation official who spoke on the condition of anonymity because they are not authorized to speak on record acknowledged that the locals are facing problems due to the dumping site. He said that the government has approved several projects for waste management improvements at the dumping site. Mohitul Islam for VOA News from Srinagar in Indian administered Kashmir.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly condemns North Korea's November 21st launch of a Space Launch Vehicle, or SLV, using ballistic missile technology in violation of multiple UN Security Council resolutions, said U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. The very next day, Pyongyang launched another ballistic missile. In addition to launching three SLVs this year, North Korea has launched 29 ballistic missiles, including four ICBMs. And now a North Korean reconnaissance satellite has been confirmed in orbit, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield in recent remarks before the UN Security Council.
The DPRK is unabashedly trying to advance its nuclear weapons delivery systems by testing ballistic missile technology in clear violation of this council's resolutions. This reckless, unlawful behavior threatens all of the DPRK's neighbors and all member states.
North Korea is undermining the authority of the Security Council, and how we respond ultimately determines our credibility, declared Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. But two Security Council member nations, Russia and China, have been unwilling to condemn this dangerous escalatory launch and others like it.
Russia is expanding its military relationship with the DPRK, which, by Putin's own admission, could include helping the DPRK build more satellites like the one launched last week. And our information indicates that the DPRK has provided Russia with more than 1,000 containers of military equipment and munitions that will be used to support Russia's brutal war in Ukraine. Colleagues, how many more times must we gather for briefings like this before Russia and China join us in demanding the DPRK abandon its weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile programs?
The United States continues to call for dialogue with North Korea without preconditions. The DPRK can choose the time and the topic, but the DPRK needs to make that choice, declared Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. She further urged the Security Council to speak out once again to encourage the DPRK to focus less on stocking an arsenal and more on stocking the pantries of the DPRK people, who suffer from severe economic hardship and malnutrition, and accept the UN's offer of support, to urge the DPRK to engage in diplomacy and to exercise our responsibility to maintain international peace and security and uphold the global non-proliferation regime.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.